day.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Corner of Gray Street podcast. I am Bruce, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Nolan. Nolan, what's going on, man?
Bruce, not much. Just looking forward to this interesting conversation about an iconic moment in Dave Matthews Band history.
Oh, yeah, exactly. We're extremely excited to be joined this week by a couple of gentlemen that were a part of the Everyday music video. We have director Chuck McBride. Chuck, thanks for joining.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Yeah. And then producer Tim Harmon as well. Tim, what's happening?
Hello, guys. Nice to see you.
Thank you, guys, for joining. This is pretty awesome. And a first for us as far as diving into the music video scene, which is something that is still going, but not quite going as strong as when you guys did this number here. Nolan, why don't you give just a little bit of background on the Everyday music video as a whole, and then we're going to let these guys really roll and tell us about the experience of, just an iconic, as Nolan said, video in the band's history and really kind of in pop culture history, especially at the time.
Yeah, so a brief description, and we'll get a little more in-depth with these guys. But if you remember, the Everyday music video is comedian Judah Friedlander going around hugging people. He's the hug guy. And just an iconic moment in 2001. A little background, Everyday, closing track on the Everyday album, and was the third radio single. DMB was originally going to go with When the World Ends as the third single, but it was scrapped after 9/11, and Everyday was chosen in its place. And I think that's probably a good starting point to kind of dive in here. I read that the video is a response to the general feeling immediately following 9/11. So guys, can you kind of walk us through everything and how it started?
Yeah, well, it started as a response to 9/11, to be fair. We're well on our way to do a video about the end of the world. we had written a video about two people left in the world after everybody else was gone, and it was kind of a love story of two people left on the planet, so to speak. And that's what our original treatment was, and Dave was all stoked, so we were kind of getting our ducks in a row to start production on that. And then all of a sudden, when the towers came down, Dave gave us a call on that day and just said, "We can't do it. It's so ironic that we wrote a story that's almost coming true. We got to do something different. We got to do something that lifts people up. It's going to be every day." And you all know, you go to that song and it's the most happy go. It's such a sweet, sweet song. Right. And there we were kind of in our dark humor moment, having a real moment, thinking we're going to make a story about love at the end of the world. It's going to be brooding. It's going to be dark. It's going to be tragic. It's going to be powerful. And now we're going, oh, now we have to make a happy. and still, mourn what we had just lost. And it was one of those things where, in my line of work, I generally write darker humor things. I lean that way. And so to find a way to tell this story, I felt a bit lucky, I guess, is because I've written about four or five treatments. I remember sitting down with a friend of mine at a restaurant, and I handed him the stuff and I just said, "Tell me which one you think is the best one to do. I only have a few days and I got to go. So what do you think?" And he goes, "I think that guy going out and getting hugs could be really fucking cool." So that gave me a little confidence, and we set out on it, and it was filled with all kinds of neat, stories along the way, because as we got into the inner workings of it, it was really, really interesting to see how we all saw it slightly different, right? Because when you think of a music video, a lot of times you think of a kind of a sexy character, you know what I mean? There's a sex appeal everybody was sort of kind of wanting to have. And And there we were going like, some sexy dude asking a girl to hug him is not going to work out. Right? Nobody's going to come near this guy, you know? He's got to be a regular looking dude. And in casting, we literally had to kind of prove out that, you know, someone like Judah would be far more humanizing, far more ingratiating, and in a weird way, put a smile on your face than using some, you know, sort of Zac Efron sort of actor. So our casting was really what became part of the genius, because we were able to kind of cast in a bit of a comedic sort of way. It gave everything a gentle humor to it. You know, he had already started wearing those funny hats, and so to, you know, to kind of create a little hat that was about love, and he was, you know, obviously well on his way to becoming an actor in a few different shows. And so this was just enough air to get under his career that it helped him go. And, you know, he did it. I mean, this was a set where, as Tim can tell you, it was a bunch of walkie talkies, but we were a live set, like two blocks long. It was about going up to bogeys and asking strangers on the street. We wanted committed hugs from absolute strangers. If it was someone who knew they were going to do it, it wouldn't work. But coming up to a perfect stranger and having someone say, hey, you know, would you give me a hug? To see that honest, you know, kind of interchange when they decided to go do it, it actually turned out to be really beautiful, right? And so it started to work on us a little bit as we were out there, because, you know, we're walking around New York City on 4 days after the towers came down with smoke still around, going to firehouses, hugging firemen, you know, going to police stations and hugging the police and hugging the responders, everything, finding people on the street, hugging them. It was just like it was a beautiful, you know, sunny day in New York, and the backlit film just looked really, really powerful. So, you know, in a weird way, we kind of thought we gave a little back to New York on that, because that city needed a hug, right? It was like, we all need a hug, was kind of the logic that we were following. After what has happened, we could all really use a hug. And that's what this song kind of gave us. So,
that's where the serendipity too of, you know, having Chuck be able to step aside from his day job, if you will, thinking in the advertising world, and really approach this differently than maybe those directors who are out there creating 100% music video work. And I'd known Chuck just long enough to where I knew he was a really clever ideator. He knew how to kind of distill the moment, not just for the sake of film. So it was so serendipitous. You know, the start of it was that Chuck had just, I think, landed at Shiat from Wyden.
Yeah.
And was taking on a bit more executive responsibility, but he wanted to stay fresh in his storytelling and being on set. And that was the relationship that Chuck and I had kind of going into it. And how the doors opened for us on this was John Nelson, a friend of mine, was engineering Dave's vocals at Conway Studio. And so we were fortunate enough to actually, before management, before A&R, we just sent the proposal or the deck directly to the band and just handed it to them for When the World Ends. It was really well designed. I mean, in advertising, you can't not do well-designed presentations. So we also were pretty confident coming in if we had a whack at it. So, you know, the timing of it was obviously interesting. There was a little bit of media that was created. We did this through a company called Cyclops up in New York. I was living in New York. I was living at the Chelsea Hotel. And I had done a lot of the digging with Chuck, looking at, you know, Getty Images had just come online. And so we, for the first time, you could type in, you know, famine, we could type in anything and get this plethora of visuals to kind of feed the deck to get our idea across. The first When the World Ends was a really well-designed kind of shiny presentation. Dave did I'm an American in between there. And then we came back after that to shoot every day. But I think, you know, there are a lot of people that, you know, kind of obviously with Dave, it was just there was a power going into this where if we had a favor to ask, everybody was there. I mean, the funniest call for me was we were trying to get Regis to give a hug. Regis Philbin. It's like, Tim Hammon, Regis Philbin. Sorry, I can't do your thing, but, you know, it looks great. Yeah. It was just like the classic takeaway. I mean, wow. And then I have to mention Mike Jerkovac, who is was the owner of Cyclops and who I was working with before. But he was fantastic in that he really sensed that something to get Chuck out of the stream of advertising and to get him into this format, we had something kind of cooking there. And so he was really, really important.
And through Cyclops, we were able to get to the folks from The Sopranos, that guy that was from The Sopranos. Then we were able to get
Pussy, to the little girl, Pastor,
the little girl that was doing all those Pepsi spots. And then we were able to get to the Blue Man Group. And I think Conan, we were able to get to because they had done a lot of work with, you know, magazines and a lot of portraiture work. So, you know, good at the good Rolodex, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And, so we obviously wanted it to go from normal, regular people to then more and more prestigious kind of people, and then kind of mix it in between so that it just felt like everybody wanted in on the hug. The Blue Man Group was one of my favorite because, you know, he leaves a little mark on the guy's shirt as he kind of walks on through the rest of the day, little things like that. But, you know, it almost wasn't so. There was a point in time where, we had actually shot everything and everybody was really super happy and stoked. And we were sitting on top of it and we thought we had done our job right. And we made a big mistake. We cut the studio version, not the radio version. And shit hit the fan. So we were sitting on top of a 4.5 minute video and they were saying it's got to be 3.5 minutes. And they said, why don't you just cut out all that hugging shit?
Why don't you cut out the whole premise of the video?
why don't you just show the band and let the hugger come in? He can hug people, and then, you know, then we'll just be done with it.
Oh wow!
And we're like, well, you know, I don't know. Well, that's not really kind of how we thought about it. And we're just really fortunate because, again, you know, there was some people in good places. We sent it off to MTV and actually they brought in a council. They actually brought in some people. And I think even the president had to poke his head in. I had some few friends that had called, I knew in the business and called them and said, hey, you know, if you can put in a good word. But, you know, basically they all sat around, I think it was about 30 people at MTV. They all sat around and watched it and they started fucking crying. Mm-hmm. And the honcho said, that nobody's going to change a fucking thing on that video. Run it just the way it is.
Yeah. There was magic. And we started in Charlottesville. So that's where that first set of hugs was. But I want to mention that too, because Lance Accord was the cinematographer. And if you look at Lance's work, just an incredible, very notable, highly awarded series of efforts. But there was an approach that was really important, and that was the idea to stay out of these random individuals, to really keep the cameras hidden, if you will. So it was about orchestrating, you know, I think maybe 4 cameras were rolling quite often, long lens, being able to climb through crowds. And we did control some of the hugs. We kind of staged some of them, but, you know, really it wouldn't have worked without these no-name faces, I don't think. Mm-hmm. So the build was great. And then the other thing is that holding off on showing Dave for so long within the video was also something that we had great representatives from RCA. We worked with Doug Biro and Hugh Surratt, just incredible pedigrees of thinkers, and they've seen it all. But I think it was really just a different approach to a music video at the time. We were nominated that year. And Chuck and I laughed about this. We lost out to, what was Gwen's band?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was the No Doubts jet ski video that jet ski video they did. Yeah. So,
come on.
But we did get Judah down to the show, And so when they gave our nomination, he was running around in the crowd, giving everybody hugs and stuff like that. And so, yeah, we fell short on the award side, but, you know, I think that, you know, I think we walked away with a more unforgettable video.
I feel like that in and of itself is what DMB has a lot. They don't pull awards a lot of times, but they leave a lasting impression on a lot of people that are a little bit. And I think that Dave would think that that's more important than the awards or the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, even as they kind of got shunned a couple years ago. And who knows how that'll go. You guys were starting to dive into it some, and I want to hear more. Like, what's the actual filming and production of the video like when you have to be, you know, you're almost like candid camera a little bit. And then you're not having to worry about so much the audio of what's going on, but the video. And then how did you choose, well, we're going to do this in Charlottesville, this in New York. You know, how did maybe some of that come to be, and what were the different challenges that may have come with obviously a small town in one of the biggest cities in the world?
Right. Let me start, Chuck, but I want you to chime in. You, as a producer, you really have to let the creative get that idea straight before the business of it gets straight. So my commitment is always to staying true to the idea, and with clients and with management and with all these other little angles that can poke at a good idea. My job is to be a little bit of a defensive mechanism to protect the creative. But anyway, Chuck, you start with the idea, I guess, and then I can go into some of the funny parts about the production.
Yeah. Well, we knew we decided on Charlotte for two reasons. One, we wanted to have some rural, more suburban like settings that are just, you know, kind of small town feeling, because we didn't all want it to be New York City. And we also wanted to be where Dave was, and he was at his ranch just outside. So we were shooting at his ranch, and then we were shooting in the city. And then we'd go to New York. Everywhere we shot, we were looking for a couple things. One is, where is there a chance to get an absolute natural reaction? So I would be on a walkie-talkie, and I'd say to the DPs, hey, here they come. You know, get them into position. So Judah was he had a little wire too. And so Judah would turn around and go walking towards them and start gesturing, and they'd start to capture it and see how it went. And, you know, to be fair, once Judah got it going, he was batting 1,000. He was just getting every one he could get. He was just delivering. And so then it was just, and then it was like pacing. And so what you realize is you wanted to get the rejections first, right? So the way we edit it, like, he would get a natural rejection. And so we used that in the film. Like, that was the upfront. I want a hug. No, stay away from me. So we used all the natural rejections up front. And then we tried to find one elemental one where this woman goes, oh, what the hell, and runs over and gives him a hug. And we're on this beautiful long lens shot about 100 yards away, looking in with the lens. And it looked like we were, you know, complete I spy kind of moment there. And there's a big cymbal hit right there. And then things shift. And then it was like, okay, then we're in, you know, parts of the village, and we were just on a sidewalk, getting a hug. It was getting a little easier. He was getting more successful. And then we knew we had to get the timid, then a hug. We knew we had to get the not timid and a hug. Then we needed like the fuck yeah, come and give you a hug kind of moment. So we kept on bracketing those, and we knew that they would edit a certain way. So whether we got a big hug in Charlotte or a big hug in New York, we knew we could use it because it's a big hug. We just jumped to that location. It didn't matter. But you know, once we started dealing with the celebrities, it was always a big hug. So it was never any of that bracketing. And we knew that could go rise. I mean, he even hugged a horse in a moment of spontaneity, and he ends up being allergic to horses.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And he's like, his eyes were watering. We had to do like this whole emergency skin clean thing just to even use him for the rest of the day. But it was fun because, you know, once we got into the more purposeful locations, it became, you know, it was just get in and get that big hug and get out. So that's all you needed. You didn't have to work the bracket of action. You knew what you were going to get. So, you know, at some point it just became easy and just let, and again, you know, Judah was, is, he was a bit of a natural at this. You know, he was just so nonchalant about it. All he had to do is walk in, and there would be somebody who was obviously a celebrity, and he would just, you know, give me a hug, and it would just work so nicely, you know. And by the, and also in the edit, if you look at it, you know, we're so in on hugs, we're barely getting hands off each other before you cut and you're back into another hug. So we started getting compressed. And then we had this kind of moment where we're standing around and it was just like, let everybody hug each other. Like, let's just let everybody that has been standing around start to hug. And we just let everybody hug. And we ended up doing this line of people in New York, and we just had this camera there, and all we did is keep on changing the angle a little bit. And people hug, people hug, people hug, people hug, people hug, people hug. And that was really cool too. People walked away off the shoot, the extras and the people that were, you know, the people that we made sure could fill part of a frame. And if it got a little loose, it's just like their life had changed a little bit. They were like, this was the most fun that they've had, you know. They're out giving hugs and spreading some love. And, you know, it was really kind of powerful. But I mean, they felt good when, you know, a lot of people were feeling pretty bad. So you know, that was just, to me, one of the things I've always said, like, you know, I've sold a lot of shit I've sold a lot of stuff that people don't really need. You know what I mean? So there's plenty of places I can go after I die, but after doing that video, I think I get a chance. There's a chance. There's a chance I can go upstairs as opposed to down.
Well, that's a great segue. I was thinking about, you know, while you're talking, Chuck, is that if we weren't so intimately introduced into the band through somebody who was engineering the music, you know, we were kind of tapped. It's like, okay, this is new. This is a new approach. But we had a really high level of trust coming in from the band. And then just obviously Bruce Flohr, I mean, just world-class management, and, you know, his reputation is how he takes care of his artists. And I had been fortunate enough, I'm from Lubbock, Texas. And you just grow up around music. It's the land of Buddy Holly out there. And, you know, Chuck was a big Cake fan, right? Like when we first started playing with the idea of getting Chuck out of the agency for a weekend to do this, it was just kind of, it was fun. Things were pretty fun back then.
Yeah.
But going into the production of it, you know, there's a lot of nuances again with Doug Biro and Hugh Surratt. They're professionals on the RCA side, so it was really a great piece of business. Cyclops ended up carrying over this business into work with the Elvis Estate, etc. But what I found interesting is we did have a lot of friends out on set. There was a lot of good energy. A lot of people kind of showed up for the event. One person I want to mention is a guy by the name of Tommy X Hancock. Just Google this guy. He essentially went out to San Francisco back in the early Hate days, and he loved the party and he wanted to bring it back to my hometown. And he was like this old shaman of West Texas music. And he called me, he's like, Tim, I heard you got something going on up in, you know, New York. Can I come out and stay at the Chelsea Hotel? I was like, come on, Tommy, you know, bring it. There was a lot of great energy, like you would expect around Dave at that time. But, you know, it was, but we were tasked with taking care of the music, and I knew Chuck would do that.
And, you know, Dave didn't have to travel, man. He got to hang out. Yeah. He just got to hang out at his ranch and play his music. We were the ones lugging our ass all over New York.
Yeah. For sure.
I think Dave likes that. That seems to be a theme with him. Yeah. So in doing a little bit of reading about the video, so 3.5 days of filming in Charlottesville, about 1.5 in New York, 80%. Probably, I think Judah said this, 80% real hugs, maybe the rest a little staged, like with the celebrities.
Celebrities staged.
I got it.
Or, yeah. Yes, staged. Yes.
Yeah. I got to say, I think, like Judah, you said, was perfect casting. And I remember I was a huge 30 Rock fan. And the first time I saw Judah on screen, I was like, that's the guy from the Dave video. That's the hug guy. Like, that's, he kept that,
for
like,
sure.
Iconic he, look.
He was
yeah,
so
that's funny. He just like kept amping it up.
The, he said something cast, funny.
We didn't have that figured out. Usually it was actually tight. We had not found the person. And I don't know if it was Jill Andrusevic, somebody that Mike knew, casting agent, put forth Judah. I think was Zoolander had just come out. And if you remember Judah's role in Zoolander, playing the coal miner's son, John Voight's son, at the bar.
Yeah, Zoolander's brother. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think
them and Vince Vaughn.
I think we, yeah, that's right, Vince. Oh my God. Those were well-styled characters for that film.
Yeah.
How did you guys connect with the band? Can I ask? Like, what's your connection with Dave Matthews? Super fans and beyond, or?
Yeah, we just lifelong fans, and we became friends over our love of the band among randomly liking the same, all the same sports teams. And then, you know, that was around 2003, actually. And then we made it a point then to go to a show together every year. And we've done that just about every year since. So, yeah, we've had so much useless knowledge about the Dave Matthews band. We're like, we gotta
you may do as well
a podcast
share
or something. And yeah, and then it turned out to be, you know, people actually wanted to listen, which we didn't. We were just doing it for fun, and now we've grown a following, and we get to talk to cool people like you and influential people in the DMB world. I want to ask, what was it like for you guys? One, were you fans of the band before working with them, and what was it like working with them there in Charlottesville?
I just knew them from Conway. You know, I was often, you know, I was on the West Coast producing more like advertising work. But after work, I would go to the sound studio and hang out with my buddy, and they just had, you know, and just got to meet Dave and, you know, everyone. And they're just jewels. Everybody was just, you know, really super sweet, non-pretentious, super humble, but hilarious. You know, Dave is just, that's pure savant humor at 1,000%. He's one of the great wordsmiths and quite the jokester. So, and a very endearing individual. My best friend was handling his vocals for a couple albums. So, you know, pretty intimate relationship there. So, but Chuck was like known for just, he was a comedy guy, like big time. And I just thought when John Nelson and I were thinking about this, it was like, oh, these guys are going to get along great. I learned something. When you put Chuck McBride and Dave Matthews in a room, you better watch out. Like something really fun. So yeah, that's as far as what made me feel good about it, is that just, it was a success and it was a good vibe throughout. And that at that time in history, you know, I still will read the thread of the video to, you know, what people post almost weekly. And it's pretty touching. I mean, I don't have much work out there for car companies or for aeronautics companies that generate that kind of timeless connection with the audience. So
I think what was, you know, who didn't know Dave Matthews at that time? He had done some really successful songs. He was on the radio all the time. I think there was a bit more of a living legend than he was probably willing to admit. Cause when you get with him, he's kind of like a super down to earth kind of humble guy. You know, he knows it's a business, which was really interesting in terms of the music. But when it came to the story, because we had gone through, you know, the end of the world experiment, we were kind of laughing and digging on that for a certain different sort of vibe, right? That was a very kind of brave, almost like future film noir kind of feeling, you know what I mean? And it was kind of, we were treating it almost like a movie, you know, and we wanted it to be really cinematic and really, really kind of cool that way. Not as much of about the band, but about a story, You know what I mean? Like, let's make it about a story. So it almost was like a bit more of a film. And in the pivot, and where I probably respect him the most is that, you know, he knew that he had kind of asked for something hard. And I think that what was nice is that he gave us the freedom to figure it out and then trust us that we had a decent idea. You know, it gave him a smirk. It was like, huh, well, that's funny. You know what I mean? So it still wasn't normal. You know, it could have been worse. He could have said, oh, that's so sweet. You know what I mean? Then fuck it. I don't want to do that. You know, it was supposed to be, you know, a little weird. You know, we wanted it to be a little off, but on enough by the time you get to the end of it to really appreciate it. And we were making those creative decisions, and Dave always said, man, I got to go with what Chuck's thinking, because he's the one that's got it in his head. And, you know, we had gone this far and we had pivoted in this way to get to a place where we, you know, we started, as we got into it, once it was done, I think everybody kind of looked back and said, yeah, every time we hit a sticking point, the guys stuck to their guns and they were right. You know, I appreciate that, because a lot of times in my line of work, that doesn't happen. You just have somebody that pulls the money out from under you and says, fuck you, you're fired. You know, get out of here. I'll do it myself. Kind of thing. Which, by the way, happened the next video I did. So it's another story.
Man, thank God MTV stepped in and we got to see this video.
Man. Yeah, no kidding. You know, that was the lovely part. It had a bit we were a little bit of outliers. You know what I mean? I think that we caused a little bit of a stir at the time too about, you know, who's this guy doing Dave Matthews videos? How did they let him get away with that and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so. It really was. I mean, I could speak to that. The vibrations around after, like, I was getting calls from studios to see if Chuck was available to do feature films, and I knew what his day job entailed at a pretty good level, and I knew he was a pretty busy guy at the time. But it was fun. There was a lot of momentum. I think everybody felt the momentum, not only the company we were working for, but all the filmmakers. It's just, you know, you go do your day job, you shoot for the best, and then these things sometimes, well, I shouldn't say sometimes even, like a couple times, these, it's like hitting a ball and it comes off the bat. You just don't even feel it, but it's way over the fence when you make contact. And this was just one of those. You're kind of going through the process. You realize there's an opportunity here. And not to say exploit in a bad way, but you're really trying to like take all the goodness that's floating around this opportunity.
Yeah. It was a bit of a calling, because, you know, again, you know, we're talking about shifting gears, going into a song and doing it in the middle of one of the nation's most dark moments. You know, mm-hmm. It's kind of fucked up. You know what I mean? I'm surprised it didn't create, you know, it could have been a lot. It could have never happened because of that stress. Just like, mm-hmm. What is the right thing to do? Stress kind of shit that people generally chicken out on. You know what I mean? They, you know,
yeah.
You know, so it's one of those things where I was glad the band stuck with it. I was glad, you know, we were able to keep the edit that we had. We kept the story that we wanted. You know, Judah built a killer career off of it. He cursed me afterwards saying they call me the fucking hugger now. You know what I mean? He's got that as a nickname. So that's kind of cool.
You know? Worst things you could be called.
It could be a lot worse.
God, right? That's so true. I stayed in touch with Judah. He would call and, you know, for years afterwards, just to, like, shoot the shit. And it was pretty standard Hollywood chatter at the time, but made an impact on a lot of people. I think Lance and Chuck had worked together. Lance was a DP, and you guys had worked together prior, right? Because I saw those harmonics of the idea and the
Lance a few times, but this is the one that I had to work with him as my DP, mm-hmm. and so he's another director's DP, and I was with them on the set. But you know, this was my first chance to do it. And you know, he's one of those guys where, you know, you didn't have to say too much. You would just say when there's someone coming and we say that's the one, find the shot. I mean, I'm not gonna be able to tell you pan to the left or pan to the right, find it. Mm-hmm. and follow it. Just stay with it. You know, I mean, everybody's direction was one shot at it. You know, so, you know, position yourself well and don't fuck it up.
Great direction.
I know.
And this is what, you know, we got this on film, by the way. You know, this is right at the cusp of when maybe a couple years later wouldn't have been the case. Just wanted to throw that out there. We were still processing negative and, you know,
cutting and splicing.
Exactly. Wow. But Lance is obviously a huge, huge impact, huge history on American film.
And I think, Tim, you kind of alluded to it a little bit earlier that you still go back through some of the YouTube comments, go through the video and see what people are still thinking about it and commenting on it today. How do you guys feel about it 22 years later? You've said all the, you know, this stuff about the video, and it seems like you still have obviously very positive reactions and very, you know, emotionally connected to it. But expound upon that if you would.
It's bittersweet. You know, you kind of, when's the version 2 coming out? I've wondered it at 10 years and 20 years, you know, postpartum that they would tap us on the shoulder. So, you know, I with Leroy passing, with some people that were around that process, not here, with, you know, Dave actually continuing on for all that time. Just the fact that he's still at it is amazing. You know, I know those things are spun. You can't really go replicate those. But, you know, it's touching that your work can be timeless. It's touching. And to do that without the long form support of studios and TV, to do it in a short form realm, which I consider music video to be a short form realm, was great, you know. And the song was there, and, you know, we got that version of the band at that time, you know, and after that sequence of music that they had put out. So it was just a really, really strong progression. It really shifted what they did from a visual standpoint. If you notice, they went and worked with the Blue Man Group right after that. Dave did by himself, solo. Mm-hmm. A girl I had gone to high school with married one of the founders of the Blue Man. So it was easy to kind of ask for. Everybody was doing that. Like, again, like Chuck said, Cyclops had a lot of access to people in the city that if they were there, Sheryl Crow's in there as well. Mm-hmm. Quick little, hey, Sheryl's over there and Chuck's right. Like, there's sure. the shot. Like, and I mean, 3 minutes.
Well, actually, Lance knew who she
oh,
was.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Sheryl,
right.
How you doing? Yeah. We're doing a music video. Will you join us? And she goes, that's sure. Exactly where are you? Right.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. For me, it's like one of those things where, you know, I don't know, for some reason, every time I go to YouTube, it's like the fourth video on the slide, on the side. It's like, I don't know, this always, it's followed me around for a long time, and I'm always glad to see it there. I've been through in a lot of short form productions, and they're especially ones that have clients associated to it, as opposed to film companies, you know, more people that are paying the money, whether it be the studio, the band, or you know, a product like Nike or Adidas. And they're sort of catastrophe. They're rolling catastrophes. You know what I mean? Shit's going wrong and you're fixing stuff left and right. You know, batteries are going dead. You know, this person isn't right. That person just got sick. It's sort of like chaos in motion. And you're just trying to make good decisions each and every moment. You know, you're just trying to stay cool enough to make good level-headed decisions. And I thought what was nice about this is, you know, so many things could have, you know, the little things that started to go wrong were easily figured out, and it came together in a really lovely way. And, you know, and that was rare to me. Like, for some reason, it was kind of like there was a little bit of a clearing there of energy where the things that needed to get done were able to get done. There was a whole lot of let's go get it. You know, we can go get it, as opposed to, no, we're not going to be able to go get it. And so there was a lot of good hustle. And so I've always looked back on it like is a bit of the golden years for me, because, you know, when someone says, you know, well, what kind of work have you done? You know, I get to say, well, I've made some ads, and, oh yeah, I directed this Dave Matthews video you might have seen.
Oh yeah.
So I'll tell them the ads, and they go, I don't know any of those things. Do you remember that video?
That's awesome.
Well, man, it is interesting. It's one of those top fivers, you know, no matter how you slice it. If it's like, it was really, really solid people around there. But I think the energy of that album too, I forgot who they had shifted engineers, right? Like the fans of DMB were really anticipating this, well, as they always are, but I think he had changed his, I forgot who it was. He was the engineer on that album. But anyway, there's all that just natural flow that's happening too with the band.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a pretty tumultuous time for the band and the fan base. They had the Lily White sessions in 2000.
Right. That's right.
And they parted ways with Steve Lily White and shifted to Glenn Ballard. And
that's right.
He and Dave wrote that album in just a couple of days out in L.A., and it was a different sound for the band. Dave was playing electric guitar.
Glenn Ballard's White Room is really famous. Like he would take, he was quite a different approach mm-hmm. than what Dave had had prior. And Dave was trying to actually get everything to Charlottesville, but they could never outfit that place like some of these 24/7 studios. So that was all recorded in Conway. In Los Angeles. Beautiful. It's like the island of Lanai. You guys know about that studio, right? In the dingy part of Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
But,
oh.
you know, I've always believed that, you know, there are these kind of creative environments. I think the recording session of an artist or artists is one of the most pure collaborative spaces. To go in there with like a first, second engineer, the band, and really kind of that's it to get the work done. Chuck and I live in a world where many more chess pieces. So as visualists primarily, you know, and I think I learned over the years to make sure that we have this when we're making film, to make sure we have the sound discussion for the sake of film, you know. And so doing music video work has always kind of kept the visual work fresh for me and staying.
Well, there's a lot of innovation, you know, there's room there for experimentation that a lot of other, you know, clients, so to speak, won't let you do, you know. It's just, it's a natural, you know, art form that's far more pure in its art form than it is commercial, I think, you know.
True. 100%.
And, you know, weirdly enough, I'm from a generation where I remember songs by their music videos more so sometimes than the song itself. You know, they become kind of linked together. And so, you know, we kind of have a bit of a responsibility to the artist to well represent that song and its intention, you know.
Well, when I think about the body of Dave's work, it's weird. I can remember scenes from other videos. It was really theatrical for a while, right? Like heavy
production. They were random.
Yeah.
They're pretty random.
They were, like put them in a desert and have them sing, you know, kind of stuff, you know, color the sky, do all that kind of stuff, you know.
Where are you going with some of our team kind of following up on that?
Oh, okay.
Mike Jerkvac and Mo, and I know, you know, so, but it was wild. I mean, Chuck wasn't really, he wasn't sitting around waiting for the phone to ring. So I knew we had to really get this thing in, lock it down, and not, from a producer standpoint, get the idea from Chuck, get it right, reverse engineer it into what we do in production, and then have him show up and have everything be ready. And I felt like, you know, that was my kind of quest in that. But I had never been on set with Jerkvac until then, and I just saw what kind of how good he was on set, and I actually for a lot of it kind of stepped back. I think Mike and you had more of a more on set time, it felt like, together. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I had a bit of a circus crew that was in town for it, so I felt like I was more client services at that point. Anyway, yeah.
Well, I think thematically, you guys nailed it, and even like as time goes on, that's Dave's music, I think is encapsulated in that video, his music and message of love, and love overcomes everything. And the timing of when you guys did this too, it's impressive how everything fit together. And that theme, I think, just fits Dave and the band and the music so perfectly. So
Chuck's a great idea, man. Yeah, you're welcome, and thank you. But again, Chuck is good at figuring out those ideas. it really is. It's like not everybody out, we may be wrapping it up, but I just want to share this, is that I have two people I call when an idea comes out. I call Chuck and this other guy, Cole, who it just has nothing to do with the industry, but just a great creative. And they both, upon first listen, had this idea of building a brick wall. Like it's a guy just laying bricks, And I thought that was so strange from two people. And I thought Chuck is more, I don't want to say, elegant thinker when it comes to our business. He knew all the pieces and parts. But I thought two creatives from different, and that's very rare, right? Like it's very rare that ideas come that way. I don't know. You've probably seen it, Chuck.
Well, I think, ideas are kind of like children, they got to come out and then fight for their own fucking air, man. You got to go.
I can see why you and Dave got along.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Me too. We felt early on that these two would have some giggles for sure.
Yeah, I still think that you guys need to shoot the When the World Ends video. They kind of play it a lot these days. Really? So I want, because that sounds like an extremely interesting idea. And had you guys, or Chuck, had you started thinking about who was going to play the guy and the gal in the video?
Yeah, no, weirdly enough, we could probably, that would be one to go back and do one for, because I just thought that song was really, really interesting. Do you know what I mean? It was hopeful, but it was also incredibly brooding it was dark, and I think that there is some, there's some part of this, especially what we've just gone through recently. We live in dark times, and I think talking about love in the middle of those dark moments is just as powerful. It's a powerful thing too. I think I've appreciated Dave's music has a buried commentary in it. And it's sort of like the one I think a lot of the greats always did, which was, I'm just trying to spread really good thoughts, in really tough circumstances. Do you know what I mean? I'm trying to tell you the truth when normally I would lie. You know what I mean? I'm trying to, I think music has always been to me a teacher, and I really hope that, more future musicians would look at their art form and think about if you think about their impact, right?
Yeah.
There's a reason why someone attacked a festival. It's because it's where good people go to be good to each other. It's, it's like the exact opposite of all that other shit. Mm-hmm. It's the counter energy. And, I think that only with music, because it's the one thing, if you think about kids, if you talk to kids about music, they love music from all over the world. None of them hate a track of music because of who sung it or where it came from. There's no bias in music. And so it's probably the one thing that this world could use to bring us more together than film, even, because, I think film has visual bias, whereas music, you make it up, you kind of put your own, you put yourself in that story and you're the hero, and you come out the one with the girl or the one that got away. And I think that music does that really well. And, I've always really liked musicians that had a, that had a point of view on what's going on, you know, because I think we turn to them as a bit of our teachers, you know, and Dave has always been one like that. I know he's a little reluctant that way, and he doesn't necessarily want to be known, but he's out there doing the farm aids, and he's out there doing good work, you know, he's out doing that stuff, but you know, he's got a point of view, you know, he's got people out there that he'd like to knock down, you know, and I think, and I know at one point, a lot of the thinking he was doing at the time was building a business for himself that, because, you know, this was the time where the studios took all the money, right? Everybody was, they were working their ass off and they really didn't get a whole lot of money at the end of the day. And so he was looking at his shows going like, I'm going to tour like fucking nobody's ever toured in this fucking country before. You know what I mean? It's going to be, my acts to show, that's where my people are. And luckily that's also where I make my money. And so I just have to keep on making monies that I can go out on, you know, making albums that I can go on show, get on the road with and share with everybody. Cause it was neat because I walked away from that. I started my own agency shortly thereafter. Cause I kind of said, you know what? I keep on making money for these other guys. Do you know what I mean? I think I should think of that too. You know, if a musician like him is kind of going, man, I'm just paying it to the man and I'm not really doing this in a way where it makes me feel happy. You know, I should have the same guts to change what I'm doing too. You know?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Great point.
It kind of rubs off, you know?
Yeah.
Real
Dave's a philosophizer.
Yes, exactly. Smart. He's actually incredibly smart too. I mean, just worldly smart, book smart. Mm-hmm. You can talk to him about pretty much anything. He probably knows how to take that, you know, tear down a fucking V8 and put it back together again. You
know? I will challenge him to that. I don't think he's as vehicle inclined from at least a story a close friend of mine said about Dave and some car trouble one time, but it's funny. You mentioned that kids being good, you know, kind of examples of being able to feel the music and just kind of let it play. They know what they like. My son, he likes modern day Thomas the Train music. And I see that Thomas the Train poster right over your shoulder there, Chuck. So shout out to my son and Thomas the Tank Engine.
Absolutely. That's the spray painting. That's the one where he's sleeping and they're spray painting him. It's really cool.
Excellent. Nice. Excellent. Love it. Love it. That's awesome.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, just such great insight into not only just the video itself, but you know, the shooting a music video as a whole, but just the emotion and stuff behind it, and even the guys that are kind of, you know, maybe behind the megaphones or the walkie-talkies, if you will, for you guys, and behind the lenses and all of that stuff. It's really, really interesting to hear. And something like Nolan said, that we wanted to do this podcast. This is the reason that we continue to do it 4+ years later. And what we find the most interesting, again, is talking to guys like you guys and other musicians and just people that are, you know, they have been in it and lived in it and are still in it on, you know, whatever, a day-to-day basis, because all of this is super interesting and really, really cool. So, I mean, my mind has been blown just, you know, from multiple things so far. So that's, thank you guys.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that I'm ending it or anything. I'm just like, I needed like a moment of gratitude. Like I thought that was, you guys are awesome.
I appreciate it, Bruce. I really do.
Yeah, for sure. This was great. And it's cool. DMB is a pretty like mysterious band in terms of like, they don't hardly ever like publicly say much unless, you know, a little bit more now with social media and Dave has a
yeah, but Dave platform, doesn't post, but he doesn't post pictures of his sandwiches at lunch. You know, and it's,
I'm glad.
You know, I always talk about in today's world, like who takes the Bob Dylan approach, right? Which is, where's Bob? Well, Bob didn't post today. Where's Bob? Yeah. But you know, in a couple of years, Bob's about to drop a rock on your head, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think Dave has done an incredible job staying private and
you know. Yeah, but to be able to kind of peel back a layer and go in depth on, you know, maybe a part of the band's history that people might not know about. I know I guarantee you not much of the fan base knew that When the World Ends was scrapped because of 9/11, and this paved the way for every day. And
it was an intense time, right? Like that morning, Chuck and I were on the phone. I was at the Chelsea Hotel. And so there is this crazy, the timing of it, the story is not as interesting. Really, if it was like every day's the video, we shot it in March or whenever. It just wasn't. I think the story is, it holds up to the, there's a reason the video's good, because all the conditions had kind of put it there. Mm-hmm. But you really at the core with Dave and Chuck, and it was a fun loving crew. Like Dave keeps things pretty light.
You know? And did you say how soon after 9/11 did you film in New York?
Chuck had that wrong. So we actually went and did I'm an American, which is very interesting. Chuck, we got a call from Doug Biro that said, look, is Chuck available to shoot Dave? There was something in the news where somebody had been roughed up as kind of like this act of hate after 9/11 in one of the boroughs. Mm. And Dave got wind of it and teamed up with civilrights.org to do this thing called I'm an American. I don't know if you remember that, but that was out of Dave's pocket. Albert Watson actually shot that. And then we came back to Chuck for every day. So there was a little piece of media that we created, and that I'm an American thing at the time, it was, everybody was giving us their airtime buys and their media buys to play that I'm an American thing. So there was a little bit of primer for every day. You know, we had started to realize how much heart it was going to take to handle Dave's music around that, and Dave's thinking and Dave's business and Dave's, he's a creative director himself. You know, he's not shy about putting his thoughts into the stream of what DMB is holistically. It's pretty deep story. And you know, again, we had such a fun introduction. Nobody would have ever, you don't get music videos that way. You have to go through A&R and management, and they have to get to the production company. And, you know, I'd have to say the thing I'm most proud of is that I circumnavigated all of that. And I just, when Dave was done with his session, we just had some really cool pages to complement the ideas that Chuck had come up with. So,
It was an anti-hate message after, against Muslims and stuff like that was going on.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We'll have to look that up. I've never even heard of that before.
It's under civil rights. It was on their site for a while. I have a funny story. So that was done on Albert Watson usually works on this white psych or like in a studio. And that's how he shot this, is just had the talent kind of funnel in front of the camera. At the same time, an agency, I'm going to say it, GSD&M. they did an I'm an American thing too, right? And something came out in Adweek or something that the title was Patriotic Plagiarism? ? And they interviewed Doug Biro. And Doug Biro, he's like, I don't think Dave Matthews counts on the creative of some small agency in Texas for his creative ideas. It was at that point, I was like, yeah, Dave's got a pretty, Doug's a seasoned veteran in the business, longtime advertiser. He had good people around him to keep any kind of PR shit at bay.
So. You guys have been awesome. Really can't ask for much more than learning so much, you know, just from the process and, just y'all's experience. And then, you know, obviously the reaction still 22 years later. Before we get out of here, why don't you guys just talk just real quick, what you guys are up to currently and how people can find maybe a little bit more of your work, whether it be social media or somewhere out on the interwebs these days as well.
Cool. I own and run an advertising agency here in San Francisco and in New York City named Cutwater, which is like the bow of a boat, with the whole idea of kind of like slicing through and breaking, you know, breaking ground that way. Been doing that now for, roughly about 14 years. So it's independent. So we're privately held. We're not a publicly held company. So we can kind of make our own decisions, say no to assholes and really work hard for good people. And, you know, and really have also kind of worked in a small way towards more branded content too, because as I think the future holds with streaming and with way, you know, so much of our media has kind of got the, you know, it potentially has brand origins. You know, I think that, you know, they're the ones that still have the budgets to do really cool things. So I'm starting to work my way into branded content. So that's kind of the next, I think, stage of my career, is to kind of work a little bit more with Hollywood and how brands are using entertainment as their marketing vehicles. Barbie probably being the best, most recent example. You know, when Mattel finally said, we don't make a doll, we don't, our IP isn't in plastic hair and a little body that's molded, you know, out of some sort of rubber. It's actually in the story of Barbie. The IP is the story of Barbie. And so, you know, they're just waking up to that, and they're doing a lot of stuff with Hot Wheels. And so every brand now is starting to look that direction about, let's look at our product or our brand as a creative entity that has an IP and has a story to tell. And that's what it should be out there doing.
Well, awesome. I think it's important too, just to look at Chuck's historical work if you haven't already. And, you know, I am still producing. I paint, I sculpt, I have most recently been with Meow Wolf. I don't know if you've heard of Meow Wolf, a little bit of a phenomenon in the experiential art world, but I'm producing. I go company to company, project to project. Chuck, I think, has a tough, it's kind of funny. I do bounce a lot in this industry, and I think it's the curse of being a producer, I don't live on the West Coast or the East Coast anymore. I've just made a lifestyle decision to kind of be where I wanted to be on the planet. And Santa Fe, New Mexico is like the third largest art market in the country. So there's this creative pulse here that's fantastic. It's obviously the land of George O'Keefe, but there are hundreds of other artists that are really important to the story of American art that come from here. I'm a dad, 9-year-old daughter, and yeah, life's good in this tumultuous sphere that's spinning within a sphere and other spheres. So yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining us and telling the story of the Everyday music video.
Cool.
A great moment for Dave Matthews Band and its fans. So thanks so much, and hopefully run into you guys at a show sometime, maybe in Arizona or New Mexico or the West Coast sometime. It'd be great to catch up. And
I see him in the Woodlands every year. Like, or that's usually where I catch him. So
amazing. Well, we'll be on the lookout for the When the World Ends music video when that drops. All right. Appreciate you guys. And
Nolan, Bruce,
see you next time.
Nice to meet you both.
Yeah. Nice to meet you guys. Really appreciate it too. Thank you.
We enjoyed it. Bye.
And we'll see you next time on the corner of Gray Street.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.